is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Mark Haney. A movie screening in Cincinnati next week shows a link between race and the death penalty in the United States. We'll hear about it and how University of Cincinnati Law School students are working to connect more with their communities on race and gender issues. But first, we often hear about depression among teens and even those in middle age. But about 6 million Americans, 65 and older, experience depression. We'll talk today about the special help seniors need to combat depression. Joining me are professor and vice chair for clinical research in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Cal Adler, and professor of clinical psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience and director of the Cognitive Aging Program at the UC College of Medicine, Dr. Robert Krikorian. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Glad to have you both here. And I think, Dr. Krikorian, we'll start with you in sort of just defining depression, what it is, and how you notice it.
Well, depression is classified as a mood disorder, and the phenomenology or the symptoms of depression and the way it looks to other people can vary somewhat with age. Sadness, melancholia, of course, are terms that are used to describe how people experience themselves in the world when they're depressed. And but in older adults, sometimes the sadness is not as prominent as complaints about medical problems or aches and pains and things like that.
Those complaints may or may not be valid. It may be just because they're depressed that they're noticing those things
more? It's possible, yes, yes. I mean, often sadness is there, but not always at any age, but especially in older adults, it may appear in a different form, the depression. And then there are other symptoms like changes in sleep is a very common symptom, changes in appetite.
Changes in that you sleep more or less?
Both. Mm-hmm. Both. Not necessarily both in the same individual, but some people sleep more, some less. decrease in motivation to do things, and especially noticeable sometimes is a decrease in motivation to do things that are gratifying or enjoyable for the person.
Dr. Adler, do you want to add to that?
Just to really repeat something that Dr. Krikorian noted, that depression in the elderly really can present very differently than we see in younger cohorts, and treating the elderly can present with some just unique difficulties because of the nature of the illness and the nature of the individuals who are suffering it. And that can make it a little bit harder to address sometimes.
Well, I guess you have to be aware. I remember when my grandmothers were aging, there was a lot of always complaining, as you say, about the aches and the pains and the in ways that it just seemed like while they may be something that was bothering them, some of it was so minor, even they admitted it wasn't that big a deal. What can family and friends do to help and watch out for if they suspect there might be some depression going on with their elderly relatives?
I would say the biggest thing is just to be alert for it. I mean, often we don't think about depression in the elderly, and we really should. It's certainly true that rates of depression in older adults do come down a bit from late middle age where they peak, but come down a bit may paper over the issue to some degree. It's still quite significant. And some of the studies that have suggested that depression rates drop in the elderly may be, frankly, mistaken because many of those studies define depression in a way that may have minimized depression in the elderly. So, for instance, in the DSM-4, the older version of the kind of the handbook of diagnostic criteria, one would exclude from a depressive diagnosis someone who had a recent bereavement or where the depression might be related to a medical illness or a medication they're taking. And, of course, in older adults, it's not uncommon that the depression would be precipitated by a loss, which unfortunately gets more common as we age. And these are individuals who are more likely to have underlying medical illnesses or be taking medication that could cause depression. And so many of those studies that showed that drop-off may have essentially undercounted depression in the elderly because they essentially excluded people who were suffering from very real depression and who really would benefit from treatment, but who didn't meet those quote-unquote criteria.
Well, you said something really interesting there, and it surprises me. You say a loss of someone close to you is not ordinarily considered a sign that would be a cause of depression?
It's a little bit of psychiatry inside baseball. So the earlier version of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, that's the essentially compendium of diagnostic criteria for disorders, the DSM-4, excluded from the depressive diagnosis depression that was in response to bereavement unless it clearly exceeded what one would expect, which is a somewhat subjective criterion. The DSM-5 has removed that.
So,
because of concerns, I think, about undercounting depression in individuals who did suffer a loss like that. And most clinicians I know would nonetheless treat. Where it's an issue is not so much in treatment as in these larger epidemiologic studies where you're counting, you know, how prevalent something is.
So really it's just skewing, it could be skewing the numbers is
exactly
what your concern is. Dr. Krikorian, as you're working with older patients and even dealing with Alzheimer's and those sorts of things, do you find that if a person does lose a spouse or some of their very close friends, that you do see major changes in their physical health?
Yes, it can be, in a sense, unmasked at that time. In particular, people who have cognitive changes, memory changes, and early dementia, perhaps, may become depressed, lose motivation for things when there's a loss of a spouse, and then have a progressive downhill course over time because there's a brain disorder, potentially neurodegeneration at play. But I just emphasize something that Dr. Adler was saying. I think it's important to for family members to recognize changes in mood or changes in behavior that might be a signal for a change in mood and get the person evaluated, because the majority of older adults do respond to antidepressant treatment.
But I know a lot of older folks, and they don't like to admit anything's wrong, and they don't want to. I'm just feeling bad. I'm not going to go to the doctor because I'm sad. Of course I'm sad because my husband died or my wife died or my friends are all dying. How do you convince them that the quality of life may improve if they actually go see somebody?
I see that a lot, and not just in older adults. You know, most, certainly early episodes of depression do follow some kind of stressor. You know, there's this myth out there that it's not a real depression if it doesn't pop up completely out of the blue. And that's just not the case. Usually something tips us into depression, something bad happened. And patients will sometimes say, well, you know, wouldn't anyone feel down around this? And typically, I agree. Where we get into a problem is where we go beyond feeling down. As you mentioned earlier, it's more than just feeling sad. In depression, you get this multifaceted presentation of feeling down accompanied by appetite changes, sleep changes, just a variety of often physical effects that cause dysfunction, that cause problems. And so what I would say to any patient, including an older patient, is the issue is not would anybody feel this way or whether it's expected or not. Certainly you lose a longtime spouse, of course you feel down. The issue is it causing a problem? Is it causing dysfunction? Is it affecting your life in some negative way? And if it's not, then it's less of a problem. If it is, then that's really what we need to address.
So you come in, you can talk to your parents perhaps and say, you're not sleeping, you're not eating.
Mm-hmm.
We need to just find out what's going on.
Change in everyday functioning.
Right.
So as you do see these folks and they come in and you perhaps do diagnose them with depression of some kind, how do you begin to treat them? What are the answers?
That's a really good question. And to some degree, there's a lack of studies in the elderly. You know, it used to be that there were very few studies in young people and children, and Congress actually took steps legislatively to address that, to essentially incentivize companies to run childhood studies to remedy that. And no, really nothing similar in scope has ever been done with geriatric treatments, and to some degree that's unfortunate. So there are studies, but they are more limited. And as Dr. Krikorian mentioned earlier, there is good data that geriatric depression typically responds as well to antidepressants as depression in younger folk. But because of the high rate of other illnesses and because of the high rate of dementia or more mild cognitive impairment that Dr. Kerkorian mentioned earlier, these can be more difficult patients to treat, and we do need a wider range of options. In addition, you know, these medications all carry side effects. Nothing is entirely benign, and unfortunately, as we get older, we're more susceptible to those side effects.
What are some of the side effects you might get from, say, an antidepressant?
It would depend on the antidepressant, but they range. So something we say called anticholinergic effects are common, and that's if you've ever taken Benadryl for allergies, you've experienced anticholinergic effects. Dry eyes, you can get a dry mouth, even dizziness. And in the elderly, that's more pronounced because as we get older, we're more susceptible to those things. And you can even start seeing confusion, mental status changes, or delirium from anticholinergics at much lower doses than you would see in a younger person. And other problems can involve the heart, can involve the circulatory system. There really can be a variety of things. And it can also affect memory, thinking, you know, an executive function, essentially, or ability to make decisions in ways that can be potentially profound. And so typically we would dose lower, go up more slowly, and also be very careful about the medicines we choose. Plus, medicines interact. And as we get older, unfortunately, we take more medicines.
So does that make it more difficult to treat the elderly for depression than it would, say, a 19-year-old or a 40-year-old?
Absolutely. You need to have you need to be certainly aware of all the options. And, of course, you should always be treating the whole person. But that becomes even more critical as we age.
Yeah, I agree with that, especially from a psychosocial point of view. If there's been a loss or several losses in the family and friends with an older adult who becomes depressed, what tends to happen is a loss of a social role, a meaningful place in the world and with your friends and family. And having that be diminished, the response to whatever treatment there is, whether it's, you know, a psychotherapy or medication treatment, may be suppressed or not as good as it would be otherwise.
We're going to continue our discussion about depression among the elderly in just a moment. We'd love to hear your questions, whether they're about yourself or a family member. Our phone number is 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks to Evelyn Stevenson for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking about treating depression in the elderly. My guests today are professor and vice chair for clinical research in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Cal Adler, and professor of clinical psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience and director of cognitive aging program at the UC College of Medicine, Dr. Robert Kerkorian. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing us your questions, talk@wvxu.org. You also can post them on Facebook or Twitter. And again, if you have a relative or a friend and you suspect there may be some issues with depression there, it's a perfect opportunity to ask those questions. We were talking, Dr. Kerkorian, about the whole idea of depression in the elderly, and you deal a lot with patients who are suffering from Alzheimer's. Can you talk about the relationship between the two?
Yes. It turns out that both recurring depression throughout one's life or throughout one's adult life, as well as depression that occurs for the first time late in life that represent risk factors for dementia, Alzheimer's disease, also cerebral vascular changes, that is reduced blood flow to the brain that causes damage in the brain. Both of those are associated with those two types of depression, the recurring lifetime depression as well as late onset depression. Depression is a stress. That's one way to think about it. And it's associated with hormonal changes, physiological changes, increases in inflammatory enzymes that circulate throughout the body and in the brain, as well as hormones that affect the structures in the brain that have to do with new learning, memory, and problem solving in the frontal lobes and the medial temporal lobe. And people with recurring lifetime depression actually have as much or more damage in some of those memory centers as people with very early Alzheimer's disease.
We have a question from Leah in Loveland. And again, if you have a question, 513-419-7100. Hi, Leah. What's your question?
My question is this. I'm so happy to see that there is a focus on our elderly in terms of their mental health. One of the comments of the doctors indicated that there's fewer studies, which is, I suppose, understandable. But as we, as baby boomers, age and Alzheimer's dementia becomes more prevalent in our society, what can we as individuals do to get more focus on the clinical studies so that there's better information for our doctors to use?
Dr. Krikorian, you are doing some of those studies. Yeah. Why don't you address that?
Yeah, our program is, I think, one of the only ones in Cincinnati where we're doing human Alzheimer's prevention research. And our primary approach is nutritional supplementation, as well as changing the diet in certain ways to promote better brain function and memory performance. And actually, we have three studies that are launching right now utilizing these different approaches in people who are middle-aged, people 50 to 65 years old. Turns out that late-life Alzheimer's develops over a period of 2 to 3 decades, and your health in midlife predicts your health in late life, including your risk for dementia. So we're trying to intervene much earlier in the life course now for prevention.
That's wonderful. Just one quick comment. My mother's 81. My father is in the final stages of Alzheimer's. He's 83 in a local Alzheimer's community, and she now lives alone. She has, she experienced depression as one might imagine. Your partner, 64 years, has been taken from you in that way. And her family doctor, I took her to her family doctor, and we had a long discussion. He ultimately put her on a medication. Her quality of life has increased unbelievably. I am so happy that she now can function like someone her age and good health should. And so it pleases me very much that we as individuals are taking a look at this. I think that's awesome. And there are programs out there. I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah,
but
that's
wonderful.
It sounds like it represents exactly what we've been talking about today.
Leah, thanks so much for your call. Again, our number, if you have a question or a comment, is 513-419-7100. Wayne's calling from Dayton. Hi, Wayne. What's your question?
Yes. My question, my wife and I care for my 95-year-old mother. She was independent until she was 93, and she's been with us the last 2 years. She has increasing hearing loss, refuses to wear a hearing aid, and I was curious as to the impact of increased hearing loss with regard to depression. Is there a correlation there?
There certainly can be. The loss of sensory input from hearing and actually visual loss, too, can certainly be a risk factor, one of the risk factors. It can also make things worse from a variety of reasons. It increases social isolation, which is known to be a risk factor or to exacerbate depression. It can cause some alienation from caregivers and those around you. And so it certainly can be a problem. One thing to address is the reasons for the discomfort with wearing a hearing aid. They can range. Sometimes there's an element of denial, but there can also be issues with comfort that are sometimes missed. It may be that she doesn't find it comfortable. And those can be addressed in a pretty straightforward way by an audiologist or by her physician.
You talk about the idea of people just not wanting to face the fact that they may need a hearing aid, but I would assume by 95, you can't say you're a spring chicken anymore necessarily. Do you think people are still trying to hide the fact that they're wearing a hearing aid?
Not so much hide necessarily. Things can take on a symbolic importance. I mean, I remember when I moved to bifocals. You can't even see them wearing bifocals.
But you know.
I know. And it was uncomfortable. It was a milestone. And that doesn't change as we age. As we hit these milestones, these markers of aging, it can create some, it can be hard. It can be uncomfortable to confront those and accept them. And sometimes it's easier to deny, to delay.
Well, again, it's important, though, to encourage the person to get an evaluation, to see what's wrong, see if it can be corrected. Visual and auditory decrements also affect cognition, like memory function, as well as make a person more reclusive in a sense or more alone. So those are good reasons to treat the problem or to fix it if possible.
Now, Dr. Adler, you were talking about varying treatments. There's some new ones out now that you are looking at?
There are. And if I could just go back to something that Leia said earlier about getting her mother treatment. I think it's important to note that primary care physicians, family practice physicians, can often be, and usually are, the first line of treatment. And as Dr. Kerkorian mentioned earlier, the elderly often respond as well as younger patients to standard antidepressant treatments. But because of the potential problems with underlying illnesses and interactions, sometimes we need a wider range. And there are some newer things that we're beginning to use. Transcranial magnetic stimulation, for instance, is an approach in which portions of the brain are essentially stimulated just a few centimeters down. So it's not like electroconvulsive therapy. You know, it's not like shock treatment. It doesn't cause seizures. And that has been effective for many elderly patients, as it is for younger patients with treatment-resistant depression.
How often do you have to do that?
Usually it's a course of treatment over several weeks, coming in often daily for several weeks. And then typically patients would want or need maintenance treatment, often with an antidepressant. In addition, we were talking about studies. There are relatively few studies in the elderly, but we actually have a study looking at a newer treatment for treatment-resistant depression in older adults with depression using a variant of ketamine, which is an anesthetic that lately has been in the news because of its antidepressant qualities. That appears to be relatively well tolerated by elderly patients.
But if it's an anesthetic, does it sort of make them fuzzy?
It could. Use lower non-anesthetic doses. So these are much lower doses. There have been a number of reports in the lay press as well as the literature looking at this in depression in general. We're just a site in a larger study looking at this in older adults with treatment-resistant depression where it might be a useful adjunct because it's generally well-tolerated.
Again, our number is 513-419-7100 if you have a question. Ruth is calling in. Hi, Ruth. What's your question?
Hi. I work in hospice, so I deal with a lot of older persons, and I experience confusion or lack of faith in a depression diagnosis. I know a lot of older people don't believe in mental health, and, you know, they just think it's ridiculous when they're diagnosed with depression. So I just want to kind of get your comments on that.
It's absolutely understandable. I don't want to get technical, and I know there's probably not a lot of time to talk about this, but psychiatric diagnoses can be confusing because we base them on symptoms. And that's because we don't understand the brain well enough to have a real cause-based diagnosis the way we're used to in the rest of medicine. In pneumonia, I don't look at you and say, okay, do you have X number of coughs per day, and what color is your sputum, and this syndrome, this symptom, it meets criteria for pneumonia. Typically, I'm going to culture it. I'm going to get an X-ray. I'm going to culture it. I'm going to give a very specific diagnosis based on what's causing your symptoms. Unfortunately, for most psychiatric disorders, we can't do that because we don't understand the brain well enough. And so it can create this discomfort with diagnoses, which is absolutely reasonable. And typically, I don't get bent out of shape about whether someone accepts a diagnosis or doesn't accept it. The important thing are their symptoms causing a problem for them? If they're not, they don't need to see me. If they are, then what can we do to remedy the problem, to make them feel better?
So is that the way you should approach it with an older person then, by saying, are you feeling bad? Are you feeling uncomfortable? Do you want to try to treat that?
Right. And how is it affecting your everyday function? That's very important.
Exactly. If they want to call it depression, great. If they don't, that's fine too. The important thing is to focus on what the problem is and what we can do to make them
well,
feel
that's
better.
That's an interesting take. Can you just talk to older folks and say, how are you feeling? Let's go talk to the doctor about why you're not sleeping, and then just not even bring up the whole depression.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So when you work on these varying types of treatment, do they go on for the rest of their lives? Are they temporary? How long do they have to have the treatment?
Often, and this is true for depression in general, many people will need it for the rest of their lives. Typically, recommendations are to continue treatment for at least a year. And then, depending on the individual circumstances, you might discuss tapering the medication. But it would depend a lot on the individual circumstances. Is this a new phenomena or something that's longstanding? Is it clearly related to an underlying illness that isn't going away? How, in a word, dangerous was the depression? How dangerous would a recurrence be? And so this is something that really should be addressed on a very individualized basis. But one thing that I would very much emphasize is that these medications should never be stopped abruptly. They typically need to be tapered. And so it's very important, if you're going to stop the medication, to work with your prescriber.
We're just about out of time, but one quick question. Is there any risk for suicide more so in elderly folks because of depression? Do you find that a concern?
Absolutely. Suicide rates peak in the older elderly, 80, 85 plus. It's the highest rate of any age group. They are somewhat lower in the younger elderly.
Which would be 65 to 80?
Yeah, roughly.
Ish.
Right. But still quite high. One thing to be clear is that when you look at the percentage of deaths due to suicide, as you get older, that number can get lower, but only because people are unfortunately dying of other things. But the rates of suicide can still be quite high.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here today. It's been an enlightening conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking about depression in the elderly today. My guests were Professor and Vice Chair for Clinical Research in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Cal Adler, and Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience and Director of the Cognitive Aging Program at the UC College of Medicine, Dr. Robert Krikorian. In just a moment, we'll talk about a film screening in Cincinnati next week showing the link between race and the death penalty, and we'll hear how UC law students are learning about race and gender issues in their community.